Okay, so here we are. This is the second lecture in Chapter 11. Chapter 11 is on business cycles. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk about an article in yesterday's Wall Street Journal. And it's called Divergent Paths Set for, should be the Fed and ACB, which is the European Central Bank. So the Federal Reserve is our central bank. And the Euro nations have a central bank called the European Central Bank. Well, here's the point. See, when we let the market dictate events, when no one is in charge, when no one makes decisions, we simply let the market determine events, and then the market does its thing, period. And it's hard to beat Mr. Market, but we don't have a free market in banking, especially. And so, when you don't have a free market, you have certain individuals making decisions. What are the chances that those individuals will make decisions that actually make things worse instead of better? Like what's happening today, both Europe and America is faced with the same situation, but the experts are doing the opposite things. What we're doing in America is the opposite of what they're doing in Europe, which is one of the points to this. In fact, that's the whole heading in this article here, the divergent paths set for the Federal Reserve and the European Central Bank, that they're faced with the same problem, but they've got directly opposite solutions to the problem. Now, usually what I do is I cross out or I highlight paragraphs that I'm going to read, but in this case, I actually crossed out paragraphs that I'm not going to read because I'm going to spend more time on this than I usually do. But, you know, what good is it to take this economics course and walk out of here at the end of the semester and not understanding what's happening in the world? Or what good is this course if you watch the news or pick up a newspaper and it's just gobbledygook? I mean, it's all Greek. You don't understand it. See, and that's really the purpose of this. I mean, if you finish this course and you pick up a newspaper and read an article and you don't understand it, well then, you know, I feel I haven't done my job. So it says developments in the U.S. and European economies this week are set to widen the gap between the likely path of interest rates in the two regions and add to currency market turbulence that has produced a 12% increase in the value of the dollar against the euro since the start of the year. Now, the dollar has increased 12% relative to the euro. Now, is that for America? Is that good or bad? Well, with a lot of questions, it really is. The answer to that is it all depends. See, who benefits from if the dollar revalues 12% relative to the euro? Then who benefits? Who benefits? The American consumer benefits, right? Because the dollar has more buying power, see, in foreign countries. But who is hurt? I'm thinking that that's possible in the long run, the government, but no, it's the American producer. You got imports and you got exports. See, so many American producers sell to foreigners. Now, when the value of the dollar goes up, what happens to the price of American products to foreigners? Yeah, they're more expensive. So the American producer is hurt by the high dollar. The American consumer benefits from the high dollar. But that's only in the short run, because in the longer run, the high value of the dollar hurts everybody. Why? Well, what happens to jobs if producers go out of business? Right, exactly. So I mean, if you're looking at long-term growth, do you want your currency to be high or low relative to other currencies? low, right? That's what a currency war is. A currency war is countries taking action to lower the value of their currencies, because that's what stimulates long-term growth. All right? Okay, so it says the European Central Bank is expected to drive Eurozone interest rates even further into negative territory. Negative territory. What does that mean? No, see, interest rates in Europe are negative. Now, what that means is that if you put money in a savings account, you've got to pay the bank money to keep your money there.
Wow.
That's where a negative interest rate is. In Sweden, all interest rates are negative. That means that if you borrow money, the bank has to pay you. Are you with me on this? We're living in an insane asylum. This is crazy. Okay, the Europeans, I couldn't make this stuff up. The European Central Bank is expected to drive Eurozone interest rates even further into negative territory, below zero, when its policymaking committee meets Thursday. That's tomorrow. A day later, the U.S. jobs data for November, this month, or last month, are widely predicted to confirm the Federal Reserve's course to raise rates as soon as mid-December, the first increase in 9 years. So America is experiencing rise in interest rates. Europe is experiencing falling interest rates. All right, and so the Fed is contemplating, and this is a big if, or at least they're contemplating raising the federal funds rate by maybe 0.25%.
Wow.
Now, that's right. Wow. So, you know, what is the federal funds rate? The federal funds rate is the interest rate that banks pay to borrow money from the Federal Reserve. See, remember, there are only two interest rates that the Federal Reserve actually controls: the federal funds rate and the discount rate. Now I got that wrong. The discount rate is the interest rate that banks pay to borrow money from the Federal Reserve. The federal funds rate is the interest rate that one bank pays another bank to borrow money. So when we're talking about raising interest rates, maybe, which would be a big deal after 9 years, is maybe 0.25% increase in the federal funds rate, period.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah. But if the Federal Reserve does raise the federal funds rate by 0.25%, I don't think it would be more than that. If they do raise by 25 basis points, it's called 0.25%, that would be like big news. Okay, the European Central Bank, which began forcing institutions to pay in order to park money with it in June of 2014. So in Europe, when commercial banks park their money with the European Central Bank, they have to pay for that service. In America, when commercial banks deposit money at the Federal Reserve, they earn interest. Now, that's two opposite policies, right? You with me on this? See, that's one of the points to this article. We're faced with the same problem, but yet we're coming out with different policies to fix the problem, but completely opposite policies. Okay, the European Central Bank, which the hope is that the rate of negative 0.3% or negative now 4% will raise the cost of storing cash with the European Central Bank to the point where banks will instead choose to put it to work in the riskier private sector, pumping life into the struggling European economy. See, this is one of the reasons why in America, how could we have quantitative easing three times, big pushes to what's quantitative easing? To create money. Now, who can create money? Only the Federal Reserve. Right? The Federal Reserve creates money out of thin air to buy bonds, either from the federal government or from banks or other financial institutions. Okay, why is it that we have practiced quantitative easing, we've greatly increased the money supply, and yet we have not got inflation? And the answer is because in order to get inflation, that money has got to get into circulation. But if banks can lend the money to individuals at a very low interest rate, but they could park the money at the Federal Reserve and get maybe even a higher interest rate with absolutely no risk, what are they going to do? They're going to park it at the Federal Reserve. And if they park at the Federal Reserve, that newly created money doesn't get into circulation. And that's one of the reasons, in America anyway, why even though we've greatly increased the money supply, we don't have inflation. But when you get individuals making decisions, that was the whole reason why I showed you this video with Ben Bernanke in the Federal Reserve. I mean, here's the expert, and his predictions were not only incorrect, but they were 100% off base. So are you going to give people who have insufficient knowledge and understanding making decisions? See, that's what you can get if you don't let the market dictate events. If individuals dictate events, which is what we have now, and that's one purpose of this article. Here, we don't have a free market, and we've got officials in America making certain decisions, and then officials in Europe making other decisions, and they're totally different. No, money's not real. No, currency. No, it's not. That's why some economists don't even call dollar bills money. It's currency, which we use to, in financial transactions, but it's not money in a true sense, because it's not real. It's a debt. I mean, if you look at the top of a dollar bill, it's a Federal Reserve note. Well, what is it? Well, a note is an IOU. IOU to who? To the Federal Reserve. Our money is simply debt owed to the Federal Reserve. That's what it says on the top of every dollar bill. I mean, it's in plain sight. Exactly. In fact, they're actually creating money, lending it to people, and then charging them interest, forcing those when those people pay the money back. See, it's more about control than making money. Okay, I'll read this again. The hope is that the rate of -3 or -0.4, not 4%, but it's 0.4%, will raise the cost of storing cash with the European Central Bank to the point where banks will instead, because see, in Europe, if they have to pay to park money at the European Central Bank, then they have less incentive to park money at the central bank, and therefore more incentive to lend that money out. That's what this is saying. The banks will instead choose to put it to work in the riskier private sector. See, it's riskier because when you lend it to individuals, there are more risk involved than if you simply park it at the central bank. Pumping life into the struggling European economy. The move could also make European assets less attractive. Now, I had to think about this one. The move of banks putting money back, lending money to individuals, it's getting money back into the economy. It says the move could make European assets less attractive compared to other economies. Now, I had to think about that. A lot of this, you just got to use your logical, you got to reason it out, you got to think about it. So what it's saying here is that if in Europe now, if banks lend more money out, what happens to the money supply? It increases. And when the supply of anything increases, what happens to the price or the value? It goes down. And that's what they're saying here. You see, they're saying the move could also make European assets less attractive compared to other economies, okay, because of the higher prices. When the value of a currency goes down, what happens is buying power. When you get more of it and the value of each unit goes down, then then what happens? Well, the buying power goes down, right? I mean, it takes more of them. You know, that's what inflation is. It takes more units, more currency units to buy things. The divergent paths for the Fed and the European Central Bank could strengthen the dollar even further against the euro. The divergent paths for the Fed. Now, when you're comparing currency values, it's always relative to. In other words, if the euro goes down in value, then what happens to the, even if nothing's changed for the dollar, what happens to the value of the dollar? It goes up because it's always it's always relative to. So if European banks lend out more money, the money supply increases, the value of each, the value therefore goes down, the euro goes down in value, then everything else being equal, what happens to the value of the dollar? It goes up. And that's what they're saying here. So you got to think about these things. The divergent paths for the Fed and the European Central Bank could strengthen the dollar even further against the euro, crimping U.S. exporters. That's what I was talking about. When the dollar goes up in value, who's hurt? American businesses, especially those who export. And that's what they're saying here. The dollar is close to a 12-year high right now. The dollar is close to a 12-year high. The currency's strengthening reflects expectations of robust U.S. growth. Now, I had to really think about this. U.S. robust expectations. Whose expectations? It's the government's expectations. You know, I mean, I don't have those expectations. But it's like with Ben Bernanke. You know, he's saying, hey, things are great. You know, our policies are working. Have faith in us. So that's what the positive. That's where the positive expectations are coming from. Strengthening, the dollar is close to 12-year high, but it will also complicate the Fed's push to get inflation to its 2% target. So, see, in America, the Federal Reserve has a target of 2% inflation. So it's trying to adjust things, you know, to hit that target. And like I say, it's a lot of these things look good on paper, but in reality, it doesn't work. At best, the negative rate policy. Now we're talking about Europe. See, one problem, one challenge with this article is that it's comparing America and Europe. So you've got to, when you read something, you got to think, well, now are they talking about America or are they talking about Europe? At best, the negative rate policy allows European central banks facing deflation risks. Now, what's deflation? Well, inflation is a rise in the average price level. Deflation is a fall in the average price level. And you might say, well, deflation is good. Well, again, you get winners and losers. Who gains by deflation? Consumers. But who is hurt by deflation? Producers. This should support lending and weaken European currencies, boosting exports and inflation. So again, this policy should support lending, more lending. Therefore, what? Weaken European currencies, right? Increase lending, more supply. Value of each goes down. We got a weaker currency, which is good in terms of long-term growth. But it's not good if you're in a currency war and the only reason the value of the currency is going down is that you've got policymakers making certain decisions. In other words, it's not the market that's determining these events, but it's individuals in different countries making decisions. I would say, it says, but if central banks deploying this tool, the European Central Bank, the Swiss National Bank, Sweden's bank, okay, I should have crossed this out. If negative rates get passed on to a wide range of big and small depositors, businesses and consumers may hoard cash too. Why are business consumers going to hoard cash? Well, why put your money in the bank if you got to pay the bank to keep your money? I mean, the whole purpose of interest rates is to encourage people to save. Well, if positive interest rates encourage people to save, what do negative interest rates do? Discourage people to save. That's what they're saying. But it's even more than spending, because what is the primary cause of the robust growth in our stock market over the past several years? If people with money, and usually people, you know, not the millennials, but older people usually, if they can't get a good return in interest, then, but they want, they need a good return for the retirement, what are they willing to do? Exactly, exactly, right. So it's more than, you know, you're right, spending, but it's also investing. So it does, it changes the makeup of the economy. Here's the idea behind negative interest rates. Some central banks have pumped freshly created money into financial markets. See? Is Europe doing the same thing as the Federal Reserve? Are they? Is the European Central Bank creating money out of thin air? Yeah. So we're, you know, almost all countries are on the same song page here. So here's the idea behind negative interest rates. Some central banks have pumped freshly created, that word create means to make something from nothing, freshly created money into financial markets by purchasing bonds from banks or lending them or lending cheaply to them. Now, also to the, didn't say this, but also to the federal government. In the old days, those financial institutions might have simply parked their excess reserves back at the central bank. Now, when they say the old days, again, I had to think about that, but they're talking about Europe here, and Europe used to do what we do. But remember, we're doing opposite policies now. The hope now is that negative deposit rate will force banks to do one of two things: increase riskier lending in the private sector. Well, that's good for long-term growth, right? To increase risks, or use newly created central bank money to buy foreign assets, weakening the exchange rate. You gotta stretch your imagination on these things. Okay, I'm almost done here. Still, the European Central Bank officials are convinced that negative rates and large-scale asset purchases, now when they say large-scale asset purchases, they're talking about quantitative easing. They're talking about creating money. How many people can really believe that you can make things better by simply creating money? With no, you know, there's no pain involved here. It's just, you just push a few keys on the computer, you simply create a bunch of money, and you kind of, you know, they, at one time they called Ben Bernanke Helicopter Ben, because it was like, you know, the Federal Reserve was flying over the economy in an airplane and just shuffling money out the window. Essentially, that's what happened. Still, European central officials are convinced that negative rates and large-scale asset purchases are a powerful combo to boost activity and prices by increasing incentives to lend to households and businesses rather than accepting tiny or negative returns on government bonds or depositing at central bank. See, again, it's the point here is that the market is nowhere in sight. I mean, like nowhere. It's totally, you know, all of this is totally controlled by individuals making certain decisions. And they appear comforted by the experience of Switzerland and Denmark, where the deposit rate is more deeply negative at 0.75%, and Sweden, which has gone below zero, not only with its deposits, but with its lending rate as well. Now, what that means is, again, in Sweden, if you borrow money, then you're paid to borrow money. And if you lend money, it costs you to lend money. I mean, usually when you lend somebody money, you've got to get a return on that, correct? I mean, you lend them money, you charge them interest. Interest is what people, the price pay that people pay to borrow money. But in Sweden, if you lend money, you've got to pay someone. You've got to pay the person who you lend money to. That's what negative interest rates are. Can you see how wacky this is? This is crazy. In a market economy, I mean, if it were a market economy, it would make no sense. In an economy where people make decisions based on risk and based on anticipated return, it makes no sense to lend money to pay someone so that you can lend them money. I mean, what is that? I mean, that would be impossible in a market economy, and only possible through a contortion of ideas that I don't know where they came from. Well, I don't know if it's working. It's just an experiment. In fact, they mentioned that word twice in this article, experiment. This is all an experiment. It's never been done before in the history of the world. Okay, which is really the point here. Another pitfall to all this is psychological. Crisis-like policies could make people think there is a crisis. If you come out with these wild policies that have never happened before, even if you don't have a crisis, what they're saying here is that people will look at that as saying, well, this can only happen in a crisis situation, and therefore think there's a crisis and act accordingly, which is always bad for the economy. All right, this is the last paragraph. Whenever you reduce rates, you tempt people to spend rather than save. Now, what is the source of growth? Ultimately, you save, and then you wisely invest the savings, and that's how you grow the economy. Now, that should be absolute, although that tends to be in an Austrian point of view, and Keynesians don't always agree with that. Now, how they cannot agree with that, well, anyway. Whenever you reduce rates, you tempt people to spend rather than save, but in an extreme change where people say, how can you have negative rates? This creates confusion. And Karen Ward, economist at some central bank, and in that confusion, you get a fear factor, not a feel-good factor. In other words, negative rates, it's never happened before, and things are already complicated, and now you got these negative rates, and it leads to confusion. I mean, I'm confused how all this could work. I mean, they're confused. The policymakers are confused. They're saying, well, we don't know how this is going to work, but let's wait and see. I mean, it's confusing, and you can't have a viable economy when you have that much confusion. Anyway, see, I took a long time on that, but here, you know, near the end of the semester here, I just really hope that that you really do understand what's happening in the world, because these events are not out just out there. These events affect all of us in terms of our economy. When the economy is sluggish, well, especially millennials are hurt the most. Well, let's get to these PowerPoint slides. I'll just rush through them. I've got about half an hour. So I left off last time with slide 19. Now, what are pro-cyclical government policies? Now, these are terms. When policymakers make decisions, they want their policies to be counter-cyclical. Counter-cyclical is good. What counter-cyclical means is that these policies will smooth out the wide swings of the business cycle. You know, that's the whole name of this chapter, the business cycle. But a pro-cyclical policy are policies that would accentuate the highs and lows of the business cycle. So the intent, now what you learn, and you know what I the time we just spent with this article in the Wall Street, is that the intent of policymakers is that their policies be counter-cyclical. But very often, their policies tend to be pro-cyclical instead of counter-cyclical. In other words, instead of making things better, sometimes these policies make things worse. In fact, that's what happened in the Depression of the 1930s. You know, it was during the 20s, we had a buildup of excessive inventories. And I've talked about this before, but, you know, the idea in the 20s was to keep prices high and wages low. Well, if you do that but increase production, eventually you're going to have excessive inventory, and that's going to lead to unemployment, which is exactly what happened. But what made things worse are certain policies of the Federal Reserve and the government. The government raised taxes that diminished consumer demand. The Federal Reserve lowered the money supply that further diminished the consumer demand. I mean, there were policies there that actually made, you know, policymakers, their intention in the early 30s was to institute counter-cyclical policies, but historically we can look back and see that their policies actually turned out to be pro-cyclical, that they actually made matters worse instead of better. I mean, if you've got unemployment and you decrease the money supply, then people are going to have less money and they're going to spend less. Or if you raise taxes during periods of unemployment on consumers, then they're going to have even less money and they're going to spend less and you're going to get more unemployment. Let's see, I got to get to the slideshow here. One current slide, all right. Anyway, I'd want to talk about that too much because we talked about that before. Now, what is this is another problem with discretionary fiscal policies, the Helmholtz dilemma. The Helmholtz is a person who pilots, I think the term is, pilots a big ship, like an ocean liner. Now, the pilots have to be, of these ships, have to be very skilled and experienced because of the lag. These are boat, you know, these ships weigh, you know, hundreds of tons. And they don't steer like a car steers. You know, with a car, you turn the wheel to the left, you go left. Turn to the right, it goes to the right. You put the brakes on, it stops. But with these big ships, you've got these long lag effects. I mean, if you turn the wheel to the right, well, it takes a while for the ship to respond to start turning to the right. And then if you want to turn back to the left, you turn the wheel again, but the ship doesn't respond right away. It continues to the right, and then after a time lag, then it slowly begins to move back to the left. See, there are these long lag effects. And so the problem with discretionary fiscal policy is what is called the Helmholtz dilemma. The Helmholtz dilemma is, I mean, if you can picture an ocean liner going from New York to London, England, then if you're not experienced, you would zigzag all across the Atlantic, because you're headed too far south, so you turn the wheel to the left, and then as you're headed toward London, you would turn it to the right, but the boat doesn't turn to the right; it keeps going to the left because of the momentum. See what I mean? And that's kind of like what discretionary fiscal policies are like. There are these long lag effects, and therefore it's difficult to make correct discretionary fiscal decisions. Now, when I say discretionary fiscal decisions, that's when someone has to make a decision to do this or do that. Remember, fiscal policies can be automatic stabilizers or discretionary fiscal policies. And it's with the discretionary fiscal policies that we have this Helmholtz dilemma. So what is the Financial Stability Oversight Council? Now, we're talking here about business cycles. So what happened? We had a complete financial collapse in 2007, 2008. And so we had huge quantitative easing taking place, and we had the government, shoveling money into big banks and to other businesses to prop them up, and a part of this activity, we had this Financial Stability Oversight Council, which was part of the Dodd-Frank bill passed in 2010, and the council decides which non-bank financial institutions might cause instability in the financial system. So what happened here is that banks went bankrupt. The federal government, in many cases anyway, not totally, but in many cases, the government bailed them out. And so what we've done with the Dodd-Frank bill and with this Stability Oversight Council is that we have instituted into law this whole mechanism. In other words, what the government is now saying is that if certain banks, and they have to be very large, if they lose a bunch of money, if they go bankrupt, then we will bail them out. See, now they did that back in 2009, 2010, but it wasn't prior to that. It wasn't an official policy, but now it's official. But of course, what's the flip side of the coin? I mean, if the government says, "Hey, look, if you mess up, we're going to bail you out." I mean, if you were a big bank and I'm the government, I said, "Look, if you mess up, I'm going to bail you out." But that would be great news, right? I mean, you could just do anything you want, and if you were. So, what's the flip side of the coin?
Well, I guess the banks want to set up that kind of risk and fail bigger if
the. Now I'm the Federal Reserve. I mean, I'm the government, and you're big banks, and I'm saying to you, in the future, if you all mess up and we have another collapse, then don't worry, I'm going to bail you out. Now, but no, not themselves. Who's going to watch? You're the banks. Who's going to watch you? The government. See, what the government gives with one hand, they always take away with the other. You see, they're giving protection with one hand, but they're taking away freedom of making decisions on the other hand. They're saying we're going to move in. I mentioned this before. J.P. Morgan Bank has 10,000 full-time lawyers just to handle this relationship between the bank and the federal government. See, the government says, look, we promise to bail you out, but in return for that protection, we're going to regulate you. We're going to move in, and we're going to monitor every move you make, and you can only make certain decisions with our approval. See, in other words, the control has gone from banks to the federal government in return for the safety, which is always the case. You know, people often give up their liberty for a perceived more security. And that's what banks have done.
Since the Federal Reserve just canceled their two-day bail policy regarding collapsing banks, wouldn't that threaten the effect?
I don't know if they have. I don't know what you mean by that. I'd have to see the article because this oversight council still exists. No changes have been made to the Dodd-Frank law, and it was the Dodd-Frank law, and this oversight council is a part of that. Nothing's changed. Now I don't know. I'd have to, maybe you email me and I'll give me the article and I'll read it next time and comment on it. Hard for me to comment on something, you know, that I don't know anything, I don't know the specifics. What is the significance of the federal the oversight council, financial oversight council, all banks with assets of more than $50 billion and any other financial businesses deemed large enough will be regulated by the Fed and protected with the promise of bailouts if they get into financial trouble. This is our the new world that we live in since 2007-2008. Oh man, that's a good question. Oh well, perfect answer to that question is in the next chapter we're going to learn the history of this financial collapse, and what happened is that at one point the Federal Reserve had, and the government, invited the leaders of all the big banks, and they said, "Look, we're going to bail you out." And some banks said, "Well, I don't want your money." And the government said, "Well, tough. You're going to have to accept it. You know, you have to do everything we say. And if you don't, we're going to go on the news and we're going to badmouth you, and your stock is going to go. It's going to sink." So they were threatened. I mean, there were some banks willingly, you know, went along with it, but there were other individuals, you know, bank presidents did not want to be a part of this, but they were, I mean, the video that I show you talks about this, you know, on the that's part of this chapter 12 chapter. That's a good question. What past examples of government protecting big business? Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac was bailed out. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, now remember, they are institutions that don't lend money, but they are quasi-government institutions that buy mortgages from banks. And Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac have purchased the vast majority of mortgages in America. And then what do? Well, and again, this is coming up in chapter 12, but they put these into these big packages, and then they sell off these debts piecemeal. And I'll explain, you know, exactly how that works in chapter 12. But anyway, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac went bankrupt, and so they were bailed out. Many banks were bailed out. General Motors and Chrysler were bailed out. I mean, actually, there was a whole bunch of companies that were bailed out. What effect does the foreign sector have on the economy? It can be pro-cyclical or counter-cyclical. It depends on the situation. How do we compare real GDP as a percent year to year? Well, what this really takes us into is how do you know? If you're talking about a business cycle, then you're talking about growth. Either you're growing or you're not growing, you're receding, things are getting worse, things are getting better. And the way we measure, one way of measuring this is to calculate GDP and then to take the percentage difference from one period to the next. And anyway, I've talked about this before. We're running out of time here. Now, this would be a good way to end this with. I got a couple minutes. Leakages and injections. These are terms. A leakage is when money is taken out of the system, out of the market, the system, the economic system. That's a leakage. How is money taken out of the system? Well, when we put money in the bank, that money is no longer in circulation, and that's called a leakage. Or when we buy products from foreigners, that money leaves our system, so that's what's called a leakage. Now, an injection is when money comes into the system. How does money come into the system? Well, when banks lend money, that's an injection. When foreigners buy from us, that's an injection. So money leaves the system, money enters the system, okay? Now, I'm kind of running out of time, but there is an equilibrium where planned injections equal planned leakages. And very quickly, and I'll just use one example, I can use banks. If injections were greater than leakages, now let's see, injections can't be greater than leakages, but anticipated injections can be greater than anticipated leakages. In other words, banks can want to lend out more money than are being deposited in the banks. And what will happen is that interest rates will go up, if that's the case. But if I'm trying to rush through this thing, and I'm afraid I won't be able to because I'm too rushed. But you can read this in the book. But it's important to understand that in economics, the concept of the equilibrium is very important. The equilibrium is defined as a tendency toward. And if I had time, I would show you that that there's a tendency for the amount of money that enters the economy equals the amount of money leaving the economy. I explained it before in terms of imports and exports. If we export more than we import, then that's going to affect the value of the dollar internationally. If we import more than we export, that affects the value of the dollar internationally. And then the whole thing becomes a self-adjusting mechanism, which is really an explanation of how markets work. Anyway, I have run out of time. I hate to keep you at all. Now, what are you going to do for next time? Read chapter 12, right? So I'll see you all next time.
Hey, I have a question. You asked me to write a review for your textbook earlier in the year.
Yeah.
I believe. How do I do that?
Let me turn this thing off. Let's see. Wait a minute. Let me. Yeah. What's that?
What is the last day?
What it is? Almost all of my finals are on that Monday. That's what you have.
Oh well, then you can have a couple of days after that.
So probably like at the end of the week.
See, what I have to do is I have to set the dates as early as possible because all these tests are taken on the internet, and internet, like a lot of it messes up a lot of times. So I got to have some cushion there, and that's the risk of taking it later. If you take it and then your internet messes up, I can reset it, but then maybe it messes up again, and then we run out of time. See what I mean? So just keep that in mind. I mean, I really don't care as long as everything's done, by the last day of the exam period.
What is it, Friday? Last day of Friday?
I think it is Friday. Yeah.
Okay.
Alrighty.
Thank
you.
Okay. I have a question about the extra credit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is it 20 points for the extra credit?
Yeah.
Yeah. I did the essay. I got it here.
Okay, yeah, I didn't. Oh, but you got to be in Blackboard.
I will do that.
You will do that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is 10 points for the essay.
Yeah.
Just 10 points. What about the other 14?
Yeah, I can.
Well, 120 words of a summary of a Wall Street Journal article that you fully cite, name the article, author, page, number, date, is worth 2 points.
Okay, so I did like 4, 1, 2, 3.
Well, you got to type those into Blackboard, in Blackboard.
Okay.
The directions are in Blackboard.
So what about, is it like 2 points for each?
Yeah, yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, if it's 120 words.
Uh-huh.
Like if you can't see it.
Okay, so I still need to do like some of them to get the 50.
Well, you got to do 20 to get to 40.
20 summary?
Well, 20 summaries, that'd be 40 points, or 2 points apiece.
Okay, I got it. Okay, thanks.
Yeah, okay. If you want to do that, I appreciate it. And just email me, just write something up. Actually, I'm in the process, you see, of readmitting the book with Ingram Sparks, and part of the process is to put in
reviews.
Yeah.
I will do that.
All right, great.
I really like your book, Gil. It's real well, written. I like the fact that you quoted George Orwell. Although I thought he was a Democrat socialist, wasn't he?
Well, I just talked about I just talked about that one Animal Farm. I just talked about one book.
You also quoted one of my favorite books, The Millionaire Next Door.
Yeah.
Love that one.
Yeah.
Although it's been
Been several years, but
yeah.
I think it's all everything you said. I think it still hold up today.
Yeah, still hold.
The principles, are never changed. But yeah, that's good. Reading that book, you read the book?
Yes.
Yeah. Do you remember who was one of the most the wealthiest professions in the country? That surprised me is auctioneers.
Auctioneers.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, I remember that.
The average auctioneer makes over $1 million a year.
And at the time when it was written, one of the wealthiest ethnic groups in the country was actually people of Eastern European descent.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
Interesting
statistics. And your average successful businessman manufactures something that's boring and lives below his means, lives in a middle class neighborhood. Drives a 3 or 4 year old car.
My uncle's exactly like that. My uncle's a millionaire.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's actually.
And he lives very simply.
Yep, he lives in Pocosin, on the eastern part of the portion of the state. He's a CEO for the Boys and Girls Club of Virginia.
Good.
He's really smart with finance.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which explains why he's a millionaire.
Yeah. I've got a friend like that. Yeah.
Considering his house has actually gotten washed out several times by hurricane flooding, it's probably good that he is a millionaire.
I would say. Well, it'd be a good role model for you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's a pretty smart business.
Yeah. Well, you can learn from him.
Yeah. Have a good day.
Okay. Okay, good.
I'll get that for me.
Okay, thanks. Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Okay. So where's it from?
It's from
CNN?
CNN, yeah.
Uh-huh.
So I read the article, and basically is now they're adopting a policy to end, like, if the bank is collapsing or going into bankruptcy, they're not going to lend to give it money. Like, they're not going to bail it out. But in the same article, basically, it just, now it states that they might use their own discretion at, like, certain banks.
Well, now, I'd have to read the article, but see, in terms of
it was a recent policy that only happened, I think.